Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the American playwright and librettist, Deborah Brevoort. She was also recently appointed a Fulbright Specialist for theater, music theater, and opera for the U.S. State Department. Please join us as we talk about her projects, teaching, and the future of opera, and so much more. Before we begin, please reach down there and hit the like and subscribe buttons. It's free and easy to do, but it goes a long way towards supporting the mission. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the program the wonderful writer, Deborah Brevoort. Deborah, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate this a lot.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Thanks. It's very nice to meet you, too. As I was, I explained to you just before I hit the record button that we talk to people who write music for productions, but we never get a chance to talk to the people who actually write the words, which is kind of important too. And Gerald Cohen was a recent guest on the program, and you and he wrote an opera called Steal a Pencil for Me.
Yes.
Have I got that right?
Yes, you do.
Well, give us a thumbnail sketch of what it's about. Can you do that for us, please?
Sure. It's inspired by a true story of Yep and Ina Pollock, who were members of the synagogue where Gerald is a cantor. And it's the opera came about because their daughter, Margaret, found in the attic a batch of letters that they had exchanged while they were in Westerbork and Bergen-Belsen concentration camps during World War II. And those letters were then published in a book, later turned into a film. And they tell the love story of how Yap and Ina met during the Holocaust in the absolute worst of conditions, and during this horrific period, and how they fell in love. And about the how they kept themselves alive spiritually, emotionally, and physically during that Holocaust, and then were able later to meet and marry and build the life together that they had imagined while they were in the camps. So it's a Holocaust story with all the grim horrors of the Holocaust, but it's an incredibly uplifting story about the power of the imagination, the power of love, and sort of the power of the human spirit to just endure the worst and actually come out, alive and stronger from it.
So that's about as operatic as you can get.
Yes. And it's unusual because it's an opera with a happy ending. And it's as happy as it can be when you're telling a story set in that time period.
Sure.
But it's actually a very uplifting story. So excuse me, I set my alarm so I wouldn't miss this call, and it just went off. Sorry.
It's quite all right. I think everybody is so used to Zoom calls now. Little things like that are just part of the charm, I guess, if you will. So this, I've heard excerpts from it, and it's a marvelous opera. I'm kind of looking forward to listening to the entire thing. It was written quite a few years ago, yes, about a decade or so ago.
Yes. Yeah. Gosh, I can't remember the exact year that we started. I guess we started writing it in 2009, somewhere around there. So yes, it's been, and then it took us a couple of years, and opera is long-term projects. They have long time frames, but yes.
And then it was recorded. The CDs are out now, and those came out just this last fall, I believe.
Just in August. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, and they are available. There have been links on my interview with him, and there will be links to your page, so people can get this, and I really recommend they do. And he's a wonderful composer. So, how How is it writing with somebody else? I mean, he came to you with a story?
Yes, he did. He of course knew Yap and Ina from his
Sure.
synagogue and wanted to and apparently had been looking for a number of years for a Holocaust story that that he wanted to turn into an opera, and realized it was sitting right there in front of him in his synagogue. And he came to me and asked if I would consider it. And at the time I was working in Alaska, and I was really booked up. And I said to him, "I'm sorry, I'm booked. I know that you really want to go on this, and I can't do it." And he prevailed and said, "Well, just read the letters." So I read the letters, and then I'm like, "How can anybody say no to this story?" And I'm like, "I don't have the time to do this, but I'm going to make the time to do it because it's such a powerful story." I was so moved by it, and so it meant huge juggling on my part and loading up on more work than I could really handle. But I'm so glad that I did that. But to your question about working with another person, I was a playwright. I still am a playwright, and write plays, musicals, and now operas. And theater is a team sport. Even when you're the playwright and you're the solo artist, you cannot do what you do without knowing how to collaborate with a whole army of people, actors, directors, designers. I mean, it's a team sport. And writing musical theater and writing opera is even more so because the actual composition is also a team sport. Yeah, I love working with composers. I love working in musical form. And in fact, I'm really not writing plays anymore. I'm almost writing operas exclusively and musicals.
Wow.
I love that collaborative process. I like working with lots of different composers, because to me it's like each composer is like traveling to a different country. Their music, their style, their way of working. I'm not one of those writers who settles down with the same collaborator, like Rodgers and Hammerstein. A lot of the great teams were, writers and composers that sort of got
Right.
married and stuck together. And there's a lot to be said for that. But I've never been that kind of writer. I guess I'm promiscuous in my taste. I like all kinds of music, and and there's really not a kind of music that I don't like. And so I and working with composers is getting to travel to a different part of the musical landscape, and I find that very exciting.
So you've written almost what, nine operas? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, nine operas, and I also wrote a play, a Japanese no drama about Elvis Presley, which I am now calling one of my operas because it was one of the first plays that I wrote, and I didn't realize until I did my opera training that I had actually it's actually an opera.
Oh.
So now I'm calling that number 10, even though that was number one, because it's a musical form in Japan. And I'm continuing, even though that project is 30 years old, it's being produced in Japan, and I worked with no composers on that. So I'm considering, I'm now calling that an opera, not a play, because that's what it really is. But yes, 10 total. And
Wow.
I'm working on a few more. So
So the you have an Elvis play slash opera, or an Elvis theme, but it's in Japanese, or Japan is the background. How does?
no, it's the Japanese No Theater, NOH. It's
Oh,
an
okay.
ancient form of Japanese theater. It goes back to 1300s, 1400s in Japan, and it's a highly codified, highly stylized form of Japanese theater, which is based in music. And anyway, I was looking for a way to bring this very arcane, very old, and very obscure, but very well known in Japan. It's one of their cultural treasures. How would you make that kind of theater work in an American context? And I realized that Elvis Presley became my key for how to do a no drama that an American audience could access. Because I don't know if you've never seen a no drama, it is virtually unintelligible if you do not know what you're looking at, right? It's just,
Okay.
it's like, but when you break it down, it's actually, it's incredible. It's one of the great art forms, like, in the world.
Oh my.
And it began with me trying to figure out how do I make this very obscure thing work in an American context. So I created an Americanized no about Elvis Presley, and that was my master's thesis at Brown University, the 32 years ago.
A minute ago.
But then it got the attention of a company in Japan. And the no theater is very traditional. This is considered a national treasure. You don't mess around with it. You don't do new stuff with it. It's very traditional. And so, of course, there's always great resistance to people like me coming in and doing no dramas about Elvis Presley. But interestingly, this company mounted a production, and it has now been fully embraced by the traditional no community in Japan. And in fact, last summer, it was produced in the Kongo No Theater in Kyoto, which is part of the Imperial Palace, and it sold out. And it sold out in Tokyo, and they're bringing it back this summer to be done in the Kita No, which is the big No Theater in Tokyo. It took 30 years. I always say to my students, this is a career that requires enormous patience. It took me 30 years to get this thing mounted, but it happened. And so now it's being done in a traditional Japanese mode in Japan, which is
Well,
just
that's exciting.
a big
That's
thrill.
really
Yes.
that's so will you be there for any of the performances?
Oh, I was there last summer, you bet. And I was there for the whole thing in Tokyo and Kyoto, and I'm going back this summer. I mean, it never in my wildest dreams did I ever believe that the No Theater in Japan would embrace this play, but they have fully embraced it. And to me, it's like a life high point. It's a career high point. And even though it's a very obscure, form that a lot of people don't know anything about, the fact that it ha has gotten there is just one of
Yeah,
I don't know, it's
congratulations.
one of the best things that's ever happened to me, and so I would not miss it for the world. I will be there this summer as well. So
that's marvelous. Congratulations. Now, this is spoken word only, spoken word and physical acting. There's no music involved in this, or is there
no,
music?
it's all sung.
Oh, it
It's
all is all
very,
sung.
but it's highly stylized. Yes, it's music theater, it's sung. It's
Okay.
I would say it's really like ancient Japanese opera is what it is.
Okay. So you wrote the music as well?
No, I worked with a composer for a no composer in Japan.
Oh,
So
gotcha.
we worked over Skype for 4 or 5 years. It took 4 or 5 years to work on this. And no drama has a chorus and it has an orchestra on stage, but it's like Japanese drums. I mean, it's very obscure, and it's very specific. But I worked with the composer in Japan.
I think people who are unfamiliar with opera in any form and what art music or anything like that would be surprised to know if that stuff even exists, let alone what it sounds like. So I'm very very curious about it myself. I'm not familiar with it, so I'm going to have to do a little digging and educate myself a little bit. And but so I'm looking forward to it. Is this available? Right now,
It's
a
not
recording.
available on YouTube, but there is a promotional video that was done about it, which will give you a little sense
Okay.
of what it's about, what it looks
Cool.
like, what it sounds like. And I can send that to you after we
Okay,
finish the
that would be
interview.
wonderful. That would be wonderful. Thank you. So you've worked with several different composers. You kind of have to adjust to their particular style, or do they have to adjust to yours, or is it kind of a compromise all the way around?
Well, I don't believe in the word compromise when you're because if you compromise in creating art, the art is compromised. To me, it's
Ah.
really about it's about finding a place where the your two sensibilities can meet and you both can be fully you can bring everything that you have to the project and then it really is sort of like making a baby, but you're making this piece, and it
Sure.
really is the blend of your two sensibilities. So I don't change who I am, and they don't change who they are, and I hope they don't, because if they do, that's not good. And for me, it's more about when I sign on to work with a composer, it's because I have a story that we both want to tell, or they have a story, or we're commissioned by a company, we're given a topic, and we find that if that is the case, very often we'll be this happens to me a lot. They say, "Hi, we want this composer, we want you, we're going to put you together. So make sure you talk and like you like each other." And I listen to their music and they read my plays, and we go, "Yeah, we think we can work together." And they go, "Okay, now find a topic or find an opera," or sometimes they'll say, "The topic is X. Okay, do something with that." That's often the way operas are written. And so then it's about finding the story that sort of rings my bells and rings their bells, And if you don't have that core enthusiasm about it, then it's not going to be any good. And that's sort of the beginning thing. And then we sort of build it together. So I don't change what I do to accommodate a composer, and I don't think they change what they do to accommodate me. We're both sort of on board figuring it out. So that's the way it works for me. I mean, different librettists will tell you different things, but that's for me what it is.
So, do you write the words first and then they set it to music, or do they send you an idea of a melody of some kind and you set some words to it? How does that process work?
Well, in the opera, because it's very different than musical theater.
Right.
So in the opera, basically what you do is the main part of the collaboration occurs at what I call the outlining stage. And the outline is basically where you build together the sort of musical structure, or the what I like to call the musical architecture of the piece. And so, and that is a very deep collaboration. It's not like creating a plan for the work. It is the work. You're building the skeleton for the piece. So the way that works is I usually take the first pass at the outline, or I'll say the playwright will figure out, okay, well, these are the characters that we need, and this is the story, and I'll figure out how. Like what the scenes would be. I come up with a general outline, and then I will then work with the composer, and we translate that into musical terms. Like, how's this piece going to begin? Well, it's going to begin with a chorus number. It's going to begin with an aria. It's going to whatever we and we figure that out, and it will take months. For Gerald and I, it took at least 4 months of working intensely on that outline to know how many scenes and how long they would be. And like, this is going to start with a chorus, and it's going to go to an aria, then it's going to go to a duet, then it's, and we figure that out. And then once that's figured out, then I go away and I write the libretto. And the libretto by that point, a full-length opera happens very quickly, but it's because you've spent 4 to 5 months building the foundation of the house, and then it's a matter of putting it up. And then, I don't begin on the libretto until the composer, and I go through this process with all the composers. The composer says, "Yes, okay, we have an architecture here that is summoning music for me. This is going to work." They're getting ideas, I'm getting ideas. So once the composer says, "Okay, I feel like we have the structure of something," because you're building the skeleton for a large scale musical composition. That's what you're doing in opera, which is in addition to what you would do if you're a playwright or writing a musical. You're actually, the librettist's job is to enable this large scale, complicated musical composition to happen. Then I go away, write the libretto, give it to the composer, and then, back and forth, the composer says, okay, I think I can work with this. And then they go off and write. Now, very often, and this happened with Gerald when we were writing Steal a Pencil for Me, I would get a message and it was like, you know what? This needs to be longer. This needs to be shorter. I think we've missed a beat. I think there's something here musically that needs to happen. And then you make your adjustments as you go along. So that's kind of the way that it works. Every composer is different. With Gerald, for Steal a Pencil for Me, there was lots of back and forth. He would call me when he was in the middle of something and say, I need this, I need that, can I cut this, whatever. Other composers simply vanish and a year later, appear with the score, I've had both of that. Everybody's different, so.
So I know that I'm a guitar guy, and I've written a couple of guitar methods, and I know that the hard work is laying down that outline. That's where the grunt work is. After that, it's easy. Just kind of fill in the blanks. Do this, do this, do this, and kind of go down. But you can spend a long time working on that and trying to do, even though you know the material, in my particular case, I know this material very well, but literally organizing it in such a way that you can present it to somebody else, that outline is really crucial. And I hate that process, but I rely on it. I mean, I hate it when I'm doing it, and I absolutely love having it done so that I can do some work with it. So, but that's the grunt work. So I was wondering if there was some sort of an outlining process, and it makes sense to me when you say that that was really the heavy lifting there as well. So now the editing, do you get into a situation where every once in a while the composer will say, can we drop a word here? Or can we add a phrase there or something like that?
All the time. That happens usually during the compositional process.
Gotcha. Okay. So now you are also kind of get into this a little bit. Like I say, you've got several other operas, and you've written plays and musical theater and so on. You also are a Fulbright specialist, is that correct?
I was put on the roster last year.
Okay, and how does that work?
Well, the Fulbright, there's lots of different Fulbrights. It's, people have heard about it. Students come here from other countries, or our students will go to other countries on Fulbrights. They have Fulbright fellowships, which are 1 year posts for faculty members. It's all about global exchange. But the specialist program is a roster that the State Department maintains, where they have specialists in all areas of human endeavor: agriculture, public health, economics, arts, whatever. And a specialist, if you are on the and you apply to be on the roster, then you are eligible to be sent overseas on short-term projects. So it's not like 1 year fellowships or, faculty things. You could it's a minimum of like 2 weeks to 4.5 weeks, something like that. And so then you get dispatched to places in the world where they are looking for somebody with your expertise. So I just returned 2 weeks ago from South Korea, where I was a specialist at the Seoul Institute of the Arts, where I was leading the first ever opera writing workshop there. South Korea is sort of, ruling the world right now in the pop music field with K-pop, the K-dramas, but their musical theater world is incredible. Maybe Happy Ending right now is on Broadway. I'm betting it's going to win the Tony. South Korea is really huge in pop music, but they don't have opera. There is an opera company there that does like one or two European standards every year, but they don't have writing programs. They don't study it. Their focus is mostly on training singers to enter the international market. The Koreans are all about entering the international market. So they wanted an opera writing workshop. So I went in and I did a 3-week workshop where I had my students were the K-poppers, you know.
Oh,
With,
really?
oh yeah, it was great. I had K-pop songwriters. I had some musical theater kids in there. I had a poet in there, but it was, you know, they'd never done anything like this before. So I just ran the workshop and they had never seen an opera before. They didn't know what opera was. We had a great time. They did really good work. The early arias that they wrote were, you know, I kept saying, okay, guys, these are pop songs. Okay, what's the difference? You know, they were giving me choruses and pre-choruses. I'm like, no, we don't have choruses and pre-choruses in opera. No. You know? But, you know, but they were really game, and they wrote 3 arias by the end of the workshop, and they quickly got the hang of it and wrote some pretty good arias, I'll say. And I also introduced them to opera. They had never seen it, so I gave them everything from, you know, we watched the Metz production of Tosca, but then I showed them, they're very digital over there. It's the digital world in South Korea, so there's a lot of digital opera happening now. There's opera web series, there's Zoom operas, there's all this digital stuff. So I figured that's, you know, that's the way in to them, to show them that they can work in their formats and incorporate opera into it. So it was fun. I had a great time.
So that gives you an opportunity to stretch those teaching muscles a little bit and pass on your knowledge to the next generation, which is cool. So you're not affiliated with like any college or anything like that.
Oh no, I've been teaching for 30 years. Yes,
Oh,
I'm full
sorry.
time at NYU. No, and frankly, I don't need to teach my teach stretch my teaching muscles. I need to relax them a little bit. But no, I taught the musical theater component at Columbia University in their graduate playwriting program for 20 years. I've just retired from there, but I'm full time at NYU in the graduate musical theater writing program. So I'm on sabbatical this year, which is how I could go to South Korea.
Got it. So with the Fulbright Specialist Program through the State Department, is that subject to some of the idiosyncrasies, shall we say, of the current political environment?
Well, so far it hasn't been. Who knows? I mean, we're in a brand new world right now, so who knows what's going to happen there. You know, Fulbright was the Senator Fulbright was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, certainly when I was coming up, like in the 60s or something. And you know, so this was his initiative, and it's now housed at the State Department. I don't know if it will continue. I hope so, because it's really wonderful. It's a wonderful program.
I kind of like to circle back and you had mentioned a lot of the digital presentations of productions like this, which is kind of new to me. I'm kind of showing my advanced years here a little bit. So can you kind of expand on that a little bit about what's available out there and what's going on in the digital world for fine arts?
Sure. Well, this is really one of the silver linings to the COVID pandemic, because when COVID closed the opera houses, the opera community, which is sort of notoriously slow because they have to plan everything 3 to 5 years in advance, ended up being one of the more nimble of the art forms during COVID, and they quickly pivoted to digital platforms. So the first thing that happened was there was a group called the Decameron Opera Coalition that was formed, which and I was very lucky to be a part of that. So the Decameron by Boccaccio from the 13th century is, of course, that classic book that takes place during the Black Plague, where everyone escaped the city and went to a country house, and every night they would entertain themselves by telling a story. And so the Decameron is basically the 100 stories that were told during the plague. And so the Decameron Opera Coalition said, okay, we're going to do a modern a COVID Decameron. except our format, we're not all sitting in a house in the country. We're going to do it on Zoom. And so 10 opera companies got together, and they each opera company ordered hired a composer librettist team. And I got a phone call from Fargo Moorhead, and they said, "Hi, we want you to do this. You're going to work with Michael Ching, who is a composer in Iowa." I never met Michael. To this day, I have not met Michael. And so what you got to do is you got to find a Decameron story, and you have to find a contemporary version of that. And the whole purpose originally of this project was to provide work for unemployed opera singers. So Fargo said, "We have an unemployed soprano, we have two tenors, we have a bassoonist, we have, you know, so write a 10-minute opera inspired by a Decameron story, and then we're going to put it into a web series." So and it was this it won all kinds of awards, and it's now in the Library of Congress and the special COVID exhibit of great artwork that was created during COVID. So it was this thing that sort of rolled out like a TV series, right? But it was opera. And so the Decameron Opera Coalition has continued, and they take a different theme, and they hire, it's a great program for a lot of entry-level composers and librettists, and they create these web series. Well, now there's so much content that is being created that Opera America has had to create an annual digital award in four categories to cover it all. There's now like a very well-known children's puppet opera out of Canada that is a web series with puppets that are, it's all about opera. The White Snakes, White Snake Opera Company does all digital content with innovating on technology, combining live performance with digital online technology. They've done a number of things. When we were at NYU, during at NYU, we have an opera lab that Randall Eng runs, and he had to go to an online digital format during COVID. And the end result of all of this is that, to everybody's surprise, this digital content created new audiences for opera. So much so that companies are now continuing to produce it. It is actually has created a new audience among young people. And it basically, it started as a, what are we going to do during COVID? We need to employ these people. It was basically a jobs program, frankly. You know, we got the PPE money, we got to get it into the hands of, we got to do something, right? And now it's like, whoa, the surprise, surprise, people loved it. And it's so there's a lot of that stuff that is now sort of, as a matter of course, being done. To find out, I mean, you could find the best of the best gets nominated for the digital award at Opera America. And if you go to the Opera America website and look up digital opera award or whatever, you'll find a whole list of the works that have been nominated for prizes. And it's been going on for 3 or 4 years now. So one of my operas, I had an opera that was commissioned by Glimmerglass. And everybody was assembled on campus. This was 2021, and that second, remember the second wave of COVID hit? But we thought it was over, and then it wasn't over. So everybody's up on the campus, and Francesca Zambello, who was the artistic director at the time, you know, "What are you going to do?" She said, "Okay, we're going to make a movie." I'm like, "What? You know, my stage production, we're going to make a movie." And she brought in a film crew, and they made a live action movie of my opera, The Knock. And it's spectacular. It looks like it came out of a Hollywood studio. And so now that lives. And now companies are creating YouTube versions of their operas. I mean, it's like this whole new dimension to the opera world. And it's really exciting. And it's also really good for the younger artists who are wanting to come in, because opera is suddenly accessible to them in that medium, and it gives them an entry point. You know, a young writer is never going to have access to the big opera stages. You have to work yourself up to that, right? But this is a good way to get, you know, new talent into the field. So it's very exciting, and the kids in Korea loved it.
Opera is alive and well. that's good to hear. We tend to think of
Sort of.
opera, we tend to think of opera as many people do anyway, as just the greatest hits, and so little Mozart, little Puccini, little Wagner, and And so it's nice to know that there are new operas being created, that they're out there, that they're just, it's got to be, and I hadn't heard of the digital, so I'm really excited about that because other than that, it's got to be difficult to get a new opera staged and performed because the big opera houses are still programming the greatest hits. So it's like a lot of new music in general, new art in general. It's kind of hard to get it out in front of people.
Well, I think the American opera is right now sort of leading the world in terms of creating new work. There's been a huge blossoming of new work, and companies have come to realize that the new audiences that audiences want the new work. And so even the Met announced last year that going forward they were going to have just as much new work in every season as the old work because it sells.
Wow.
So this is actually happening everywhere now. Now the opera community is having the troubles that everybody else is having post-COVID and
Sure.
the loss of audiences, the loss of funding. So I don't mean to imply that everything is hunky-dory. It's not. Opera is having a hard time now, as is the theater and everybody else. But there's a great deal of new work being done and being supported and. Those companies that are doing the new work are faring better than those who aren't. And the way that new operas get produced is they get commissioned. I mean, it's kind of a joke among writers in the opera that if you want to get your opera produced, don't write it. Because if you write your opera and send it in, they won't even consider it. Opera companies want to be part of commissioning and producing and developing it. So that's the way that you get your new operas done is you come up with your idea and you sell an opera company on it, and then you get them to commission it and then you develop it with them. And there's a lot of that happening right now.
That's wonderful, though. It's
Yeah, it's great.
that it's happening at all. I think that's very
Yeah.
exciting. So, well, believe it or not, we're out of time.
Oh my goodness.
I could sit here and talk to you for the rest of the afternoon. I've enjoyed this so much, and I really do appreciate you taking the time to do this. But for right now, I'm just going to say goodbye
Okay,
and
well, thanks.
hope.
I enjoyed talking with you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed this too. See you.
A big thank you to Deborah Brevoort for taking the time to come on the show. I don't know about you, but I'm really encouraged about the future of musical theater and opera. I'd like to thank you too for listening. I really do appreciate you. If you would like to know more about Deborah, there's a link in her website in the description below. By the way, I write a weekly blog to provide updates on all of my guests. Just go to www.rogerhumphrey.com and hit the blog tab at the top of the page. While you're there, go ahead and subscribe. That way, you'll get a notice every time a new one drops. As always, I promise, no spam. Thanks again. I hope you'll come back real soon for more episodes of Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.